Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920, there's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
On the latest episode of Real Help with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by trichologist Claire Fulham, chatting all things hair loss.
I remember then going, I'm losing a bit more hair. Like, I could see hair everywhere. It was all over my desk and work everywhere. And so I went to my GP. She found five big patches on my scalp, one the size of my fist. So I was like, right, what am I going to do about this? Give me a plan. She just looked me dead in the eye and said, there's nothing you can do. I went on list for dermatologists. She had a cancellation and she very quickly said, yes, you have alopecia areata.
As ever, available on all podcast platforms.
It was a miserable, wet evening. On Friday, January 25th, 2013, Joe Ryan and Adrian Donoghue, two experienced Detective Gardaí from Dundalk in County Loud, were tasked with carrying out one of the more mundane duties of the force, a credit union escort for the takings of multiple branches across the Cooley Peninsula. Omead was the first, followed by Carlingford, then Cooley, and finally Lordship, a tiny quaint village with little more than a school and a few shops on its main street. Joe and Adrian were accompanying branch volunteers during the collections. Previous years saw multiple burglaries taking place, so more precautions were now being taken than ever. Gardaí were now often armed. The group of volunteers approached the car park of the credit union in a convoy of vehicles. It was a familiar sight for Adrian, as his children attended primary school in the small building across the road. Here's the Irish Independent's Robin Schiller.
They arrived with another credit union worker, Mary Hamden, shortly after 25 past nine, who was carrying about €30,000 in cash in her car. They waited outside for the two employees inside, Bernadette McShane and Pat Bellew. And Pat Bellew would have been joined the cash escort that night and carrying in around €7,000 in cash.
Pat Bellew entered his vehicle and then began to move towards the exit of the car park. Up to this point, everything had gone to plan. From nowhere, a Volkswagen Passat coming from the Carlingford direction blocked off the stone car park exit. Four men in balaclavas jumped the rear wall of the credit union. Two of them were armed. It was a holdup and there was nowhere to go. In 2020, Pat Bellew described what he witnessed to RTE.
Just as I was straightening the car up to drive forward, I noticed a couple of people jump across the wall and they shouted something like, this is a robbery.
The men with guns ran towards the unmarked Garda car, which Adrian Donoghue and Joe Ryan were both sitting in. They were totally unaware of the danger that approached. Detective Donoghue exited his vehicle to investigate what was holding the branch volunteers up at the car park exit.
As Adrian Donoghue stepped out of the passenger seat of the unmarked guard patrol car, he's looking directly at this Volkswagen Passat and he couldn't even see the two raiders who were armed coming from his right-hand side.
Joe Ryan, Adrian's partner, described the events that unfolded next.
About 4 or 5 feet from the car, flash came out over from the barrel of the gun. I knew then it was a real gun.
He was shot at point-blank range in the back of the head by a long-barrel shotgun. He died instantly from his wounds.
And then the door was opened, and that same shotgun and a handgun, similar to what we were carrying, 9mm, was pointed at me and I was threatened. And
the raiders retrieved the cash from the credit union volunteers.
And I said to myself, this is just do what you're normally supposed to do. Just, you know, give them the money.
Cash in hand, the four masked bandits jumped in the awaiting getaway vehicle and sped off suddenly in the direction of Carlingford.
So then I went around to the front of the car to see if Adrian was okay. Went to him naturally enough and attempted first aid, but his injuries were so horrific, it was pain. He was dead.
The whole incident unfolded in less than 58 seconds. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and in the first of our two-part special on the 2013 killing of Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue, I'm joined by the Irish Independent senior journalist Robin Schiller and Pat Murray, former senior investigating officer on the Adrian Donoghue case, who are now the co-authors of Murder in Lordship, Inside the Hunt for a Detective's Killer, to discuss one of Ireland's greatest manhunts and the years-long detective work that goes into catching a Garda killer. Robin, this was an execution without any warning whatsoever.
Absolutely, that's what it was. It was an execution. There was absolutely no need for Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue to lose his knife that night. You know, he didn't even have his firearm in his hand. It was still safely clipped into his holster. I mean, he wouldn't even know what was happening. And it's just completely cowardly, stupid, and unnecessary act which cost Adrian Donoghue's life.
Tell me about Adrian Donoghue. Who was he and what was his background?
So Adrian would have been born to Hugh and Peggy in Kilnalick in Cavan. I would have grown up in the family farm. And in around 1994, he decided to join a Garda Síochána. He enlisted in the Garda Training College in Templemore and passed out later that year. Now, while he was in Templemore, he would have met Caroline Blockery, who was from County Clare, and both of them would have been later stationed in Dundalk Garda Station. They eventually married. They had two children who were aged 7 and 8 at the time of the murder, and they would have only been living a short distance away from Lordship Credit Union. They would have lived nearby in a small little housing estate. And he was a real community man. He was obviously a guard in the district where he lived, and he obviously lost his life serving the state, but he was much more than just a guard. He was kind of quintessential pillar of the community there in Lordship.
Pat, you knew Adrian Donoghue too.
Yes, I knew Adrian well. I was Detective Inspector in Louth Division, and Adrian was one of my detectives in Dundalk Station. So I would have seen Adrian on a daily basis.
Yeah, so personal friend of yours.
I interacted with him, yes, as a work colleague, yeah.
Can you recall for me the events of that night as they unfolded from your perspective?
I was sitting at home after going on my treadmill, and I had a shower and I was all geared up for an early night, and the phone rang. It was 9:30, and it was my superintendent, Jerry Curley, and he said to me, he says, did you hear about Adrian? And I says, no, what about Adrian? He said, he's dead. And what he said to me, it just stunned me, like it stuck me to the floor. I couldn't take it in. I says, what do you mean? He said, it was an armed robbery at Lordship Credit Union, and Adrian was shot, and he died. I was just trying to take this in, like, you know. I said, okay, I'll be in straight away. And I just hung up, and I just said to my wife, don't expect me back any time early, you know, this could be a late one. And I just got into the car and made my way to Dundalk. But on my way to Dundalk, I knew that, you know, someone had to take up the baton about the investigation and get it started, and that, and I knew that would fall to me. And I rang two people that I wanted on the investigation. One was an NBCI colleague, and in actual fact, as the investigation went on, I was correct because he got the first break. And the second was James Doherty, a detective in Dundalk, and I told him to be at the ready to sharpen his pencil. We were to meet in the incident room. So I went in, I met my detective sergeant, and I could see loads of people standing around in little huddles, two and three people, and they're crying. There was one guy came up to me and he was his hands out looking at me as if asking me for answers, like, and stunned is the word. It was a terrible, I call it the station of the quivering lip, because people were all on the verge of tears, like, you know. And I met with one of my detective sergeants coming down the stairs from the detective offices. And he was shouting at me. He says, if they listen to you, Adrian wouldn't be dead now. He says, they wouldn't give us back the Uzi.
So this was a reference to the fact that armed detectives used to be carrying Uzi submachine guns.
Yes, and they'd have them loaded and they'd have them ready for use. And you'd have it on your knee when you were doing those type of escorts. But there had been a lot of media reports that the Uzi machine gun was taken off detectives. And my own staff had a worry about policing the border with no Uzi. And I could see their concerns. And I done a very comprehensive report for the authorities on the issue of taking the Uzi machine gun away from the detectives on the border.
Yeah, your point is border policing, there is a level of criminality that is above the norm because of
absolutely
the connections to paramilitaries.
And the subversive element. And the thing about it is that, believe it or not, the subversive element and the criminal element up there had a degree of fear of the guard with the Uzi. But once that was taken from the guard, he was open.
You were policing a part of the country, I suppose, that is still, I suppose, known as bandit country. During the Troubles, this was a real, genuine hotspot around the border, the nicknames of El Paso and so on attached. Was there a sense that in the post-Troubles era that these threats had died off?
No, there was still criminality in around the border. You had your diesel laundering, your cigarette smuggling, alcohol smuggling, all of that type of stuff. And it was sort of more prevalent than ever. Because the dissident fraternity were relying on a lot of the revenue from that for their organisation and that.
And in that context of the difficulty with policing the border, nonetheless, this murder really did send shockwaves across the country. It was seen as an attack on the state.
I remember well the last Concola, the murder of Garda Jerry McCabe. And the country felt the same sense of revulsion then as it does now. I want to assure the family of Adrian Donoghue, the penalty for those found guilty of killing a member of An Garda Síochána is a minimum mandatory sentence of 40 years imprisonment upon conviction, and they will serve that.
And I remember at the funeral, all the people from Dundalk came out and lined the streets, and as the coffin cortege went by, they applauded. So it was a mark of respect for Adrian and also a mark of respect for the guards.
Where sin or evil lurks, it slowly and subtly can take hold of anyone's heart. I have absolutely no doubt that there are people who today know who has caused this dreadful sorrow in the lives of so many. And if there's anyone who knows anything about that, if you have any semblance of goodness in you, for God's sake, turn these people in.
I didn't want to let down the people of Ireland. I didn't want to let down the guards, and I didn't want to let down his colleagues, the people who sat round the conference table and were doing the work to try and solve this.
You've spoken about how basically you were on the way to the station, and in your own head you were thinking this is going to be a very complex investigation. You were putting your team together. In terms of looking for suspects for this murder, what steps did you take?
Yeah, well, when I went in that night, I made my way then eventually to the incident room, and there was nobody sitting at it, no management, nobody there. And I walked in and they were all looking at me, and I knew so I went up, sat at the table, and I had a lot of manpower there that particular night. Joe Ryan was there, and I could see that he looked pretty normal, he wasn't panicked or anything, and I knew he was my first starting point because he was the man on the spot, and I wanted to talk to him to see exactly what happened. And I brought him and a detective sergeant to my office, and I sat down and I said, Joe, just tell me what happened. And he said, Pat, there weren't Dublin accents. There weren't Northern accents. There weren't traveller accents. There were local border accents, he said. So Joe would know what he was telling me. And I made me notes in that and went back to the incident room, and I got two of my detective sergeants to go to the room next door. And I said, I want you to make out a list of border criminals and border people who would be involved in this type of thing, who might do this type of thing. And that was it. And they did that, and they came back with a list, I don't know, 12 or 15 people. And I think third person on the list was Aaron Brady. I divided the personnel into teams of two, and I gave them each a name. Go and find that person and get them to account for their movements tonight, you know, and especially in around 9:15, 9:30. And John Moroney, a sergeant, he's now a superintendent, said, "I know Aaron Brady. I have him charged with offences. Part of his bail, he's living in a house in Carlingford," he said, you know. And I said, "That's fine. You take him and take a partner with you and go and do that. And I'll meet you all back here at whatever time it is, 12 midnight or wherever it's going to be." Now, most of the people on that list were accounted for, but Aaron Brady wasn't. He wasn't at home.
Robin, Aaron Brady, his name crops up quite early in this investigation, but who was he and why was he on the Garda radar in the first place?
So Aaron Brady was a 21-year-old man at the time of the murder and robbery at Lordship Credit Union. He was born in Monaghan in 1991. He would have grown up there for a few months, and then the family relocated to Nottingham in England, where his father, Tony, worked as a physiotherapist. Now, they eventually returned to Ireland and settled in Cross McGlen, where Aaron Brady was enrolled in school. He would have met a number of people there, including James Flynn, who would also become a person of interest in the investigation. Aaron Brady kind of starts popping up on certainly the Garda radar south of the border in his mid-teens. He becomes a suspect for a number of creeper burglaries in Monaghan. The creeper burglaries are where the barrel of a door is popped. You go into the house to steal normally keys to a car and steal the car itself then. So that's what he was mainly appearing on the radar for. About a year before the murder and robbery, he's involved in multiple ramming incidents in Dundalk town centre. He took a chase off Gardaí. He rammed a number of Garda cars and rammed a few taxis as well. And then in around that time period as well, he started hanging around with a local criminal, also from Northern Ireland, known as Brendan Benny Trainer. And his suspicion, I suppose, of offending and what he's been linked to escalated. He was linked to an armed robbery at Dundalk Racecourse in 2011, another armed robbery in Castle Bellingham. So he was slowly but surely making a bit more of a name for himself, and that's why he was on that, what's been referred to as the hot list of local suspects who could have been involved within hours of the murder.
When Gardaí first interact with him after the events at Lordship, is that a checkpoint the following morning?
Circumstances fell our way because John Moroney, who's now the superintendent, was the sergeant in charge of the divisional search team. I had them out the next morning to search the roadway between Lordship Credit Union and the roundabout at Ballymiscanlan in case they threw things out the window and stuff, which they did. Now, the stuff we got back was of no evidential value. But John was on that search, and he was aware that he had to track down Aaron Brady, and he didn't get him that night. And hey presto, he's on the search team and he sees these line of cars approaching, and he spots Aaron Brady in the car and he stops it. And it was being driven by Jimmy Flynn. And John Moroney, excellent police work. He took Aaron Brady out and took him aside out of earshot of Jimmy Flynn and asked him where were you the night before and all this. And he said, "Oh, I was with my girlfriend, Jessica King. I was with her and from 8:30 in the evening or wherever," and this, that and the other. And he was as cool as a cucumber. But John Moroney asked Jimmy Flynn out and asked him similar questions, and Jimmy's replies were totally different, and he was extremely nervous, and John wasn't at all happy with the two of them. He couldn't do it and let them off, but he had very valuable report to give to me. The fact that Aaron Brady wasn't where he was, that should have been that night as part of his bail conditions. And secondly, he's now after telling lies, and the two men were in conflict about what they did.
And his phone records don't quite match up either.
We checked his phone records straight away, the two of them. And what stuck with me and was a big red flag for me was that first person he rang was his girlfriend, obviously, to tell the story of the guards, Asha, you're with me or whatever, that's grand. And next phone call was to Benny Trainer. Now, why was Benny Trainer of interest to me? Because the credit union was robbed about a year and a half before, and Benny Trainer was the suspect and arrested by Adrian Donoghue, actually, and questioned about the armed robbery. And the modus operandi for the first robbery and the second robbery was very similar. So I was thinking to myself, we have to look into this a lot more. Like, this is not sitting right with me.
Yeah, so there's inconsistencies.
Inconsistencies.
From a detective's perspective, yeah. you're spotting it going, this is not adding up.
It's not adding up. And the thing about it, as we progressed our investigation, we were able to establish that Benny Trainer, Jimmy Flynn and Aaron Brady spent the whole day off the robbery together. And we had to trace all their movements, which we did. and we have, let's say, CCTV footage of Jimmy Flynn passing the credit union, letting down the window and looking in. So we believe that they were scouting. So it wasn't just all sitting right. Then on top of that, Garda headquarters were giving us reports on intelligence coming in about the robbery and the murder. And the two names coming up were Benny Traynor and Aaron Brady.
Brady, then, he voluntarily comes in to speak with you.
Brady was going out with this girl, Jessica King, and her mother had said to me, you hadn't to do with this and this, that, and he, no. If you've nothing to do with this, go into the guards and tell them. And there was a little bit of pressure on him to come in and tell the truth, as he thought. And he came in and over 2 days made a statement to two fantastic detectives from the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, Mark Phillips and Jim McGovern. I couldn't talk highly enough of them. Extremely skilled detectives. Aaron Brady had the solicitor with him the first day, and once they'd stopped the interview and said, look, I want to talk to my solicitor. He talked to the solicitor. The solicitor said, look, he wants to tell you about where he was, but he's afraid he's going to get charged. Aaron Brady said that he went into a shed north of the border to load cubes of diesel laundering waste.
Okay, so we now have a change in alibi from with the girlfriend to he's now diesel laundry.
Yes, because his girlfriend came on side, but she did tell the truth and she said, no, he wasn't here. But we had seen on his phone records that he was contacting her at a time he said he was with her, like this type of stuff, you know. So she told the truth and that was it. So he changed the story then to he was in doing these cubes, but he said he was only there for 15 minutes because the forklift broke down. He couldn't get going. And he left with Jimmy Flynn, like, you know, and that was it. And they went to a house in Dock Road, north of the border, and met a guy that he knows and sat and watched a video for a half an hour, and he went off again. He was sticking with that story, so the plank of his alibi was gone.
Robin, Aaron Brady's story is unravelling here, and he knows it. So what action does he take?
Well, he decides the only thing he can do is to flee. And at the time, he pleaded guilty to that ramming incident. He's facing sentencing at Dundalk Court. He's officially a suspect in the murder of Adrian Donoghue. And in early April, that investigation really ramps up. His family home was searched in Cross Maglen. I think when the PSNI are searched, they find a passport that's only been issued days earlier. So he's obviously making plans to flee the country. There's no grounds to seize that passport. And lo and behold, several days later, he heads to Belfast Airport. He boards a flight to Newark in the United States, and he eventually makes his way north to Boston, where James Flynn's living, and James Flynn resides there 6 months in the year. He's a dual citizen. He has a number of businesses over there. And Brady initially went over on a three-month visa, and he had no intention at all of going back home after 90 days. He was under pressure in relation to the Adrian Donoghue murder, and he was deciding that he didn't want to face the music. He had enough, and he was going to try to rebuild a life for himself in America.
Pat, your prime suspect has fled the jurisdiction.
Yes, he's gone, but that doesn't mean the investigation stops anything. But you have to understand as well that we had something like 207 persons of interest, and each one of those have to be traced, interviewed, and eliminated if possible, and if not, they were put in the pot of person of interest, and which way did it go from there? But there was a lot of work in that. In my position as senior investigator, I had to pre-plan a lot of what was coming my way. Like the CCTV footage was a whole different ballgame. We were seizing material and looking at it from the unit that we had seized from someone's house. Now, I said, if that crashes, we lose potential evidence. So what we did is we had to get Dell to build a hard drive specifically to hold the CCTV footage that was seized. And our analyst, he would have like all the detail from phones, and he would analyse them into hours and days and stuff. So we could see a pattern of who was contacting who. Yeah.
Puts enormous pressure though on you as the person at the top. And in charge of getting a conviction here. What impact did that have on you personally?
There was so much pressure and there was so much work to be done in the early stages of that investigation. I actually moved into a bed and breakfast across the road from the station, and I was working until maybe 12 at night and was up and in at 4 a.m. most mornings to brief the search teams that were going out to search these places. And it took its toll on me in that I got a clot in my leg and I went and got medical advice and had to go sick as such, and I had to go in and have an operation to take veins out of my leg. And after that, I ended up with bilateral multi-embolisms after I got out of hospital, and I collapsed in the ACE, and I actually died, and they got me going, and I woke up in the back of an ambulance going to NAIS General Hospital, like, you know. So that was all down to stress, there's no doubt about it. You know, I had to look after myself then, so I was off for 4 months. But in that interim, someone else took over my position. And when I came back, thinking I was fit and ready to come back, and you never really do get over these type of things, you know, it does have an effect. But they wanted the person that replaced me to continue, and they wanted me to help. And I was pretty peed off with this. I said, no way, I'm not having this. I was appointed senior investigating officer. I know what I'm doing. And I had a plan of 44 points of how this should have moved forward. And I was told, no, you're not. You can give a hand. And I said, no, it's an insult. And I said, no, I'm taking more or less do we just want. I'm taking myself off it. Like, and I was off the investigation for 3 years. There's politics in the guards. There's favouritism. There's all that type of bullshit that goes on, and I've never had any time for it. I knew what I was focused on. I knew what needed to be done.
Aaron Brady, meanwhile, is in Boston working away, living the American dream.
Yeah, Aaron Brady's doing fairly well for himself in Boston. He's working in Jimmy Flynn's tarmacadding business. They had another business, snow ploughing in the winter months. I think the Guard Investigation Team kind of keep an eye on the views of those businesses online, and they certainly weren't as successful as Jimmy Flynn would portray them. You know, the reviews alleged bad workmanship, complaints about jobs being done and being unable to contact the owners when they wanted to bring up any grievances. So Brady's working over there for several months, and then, as always happens with these criminals, the pressure they're under, they have a falling out. Aaron Brady would claim that he took Jimmy Flynn's father's car, Eugene Flynn Sr. He took it from Boston to drive down to New York to meet up with Jessica King, who was coming over to visit him. Brady couldn't be contactable. They had issues with the business. They couldn't get cars to clear the roads, and the business suffered as a result. And that was effectively the last time Aaron Brady spoke with the Flynns. And he would later move to New York and try and make more of a permanent life for himself there.
Next time on the Indo Daily.
He's really starting to build this really kind of permanent life for himself over there, believing that it's a safe haven for him and that he's out of the reach of the Guard Investigation Team back in Ireland.
He says, I want to help you out. He said, there are two people that you need to speak with.
They're all sitting around, and basically Aaron Brady's boasting about what it's like to kill a man and that he'd shot a guard in Ireland before.
He rang me once and said, yeah, I've made up my mind. I'm going to make a statement.
He knows that his life in America is coming to an end.
And my thanks to Pat Murray and Robin Schiller. I'm Fionnán Sheehan. Archive clips from RTE Primetime, LMFM and The Irish Independent. If you like the Indo Daily, don't forget to follow and leave us a review.
An Irish Independent digital subscription doesn't just get you the news. It gets you the best of Ireland's stories all in one place. Whether it's the best of politics, business, sport, entertainment or lifestyle. Get it all for just €4 a month for 12 months when you first subscribe. Visit independent.ie/subscribe today. Irish Independent. Terms and conditions apply. Cancel anytime.